Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm your host, Corey Fleck. I appreciate all of you joining us on really the tail end of February. Boy, oh boy, this whole year so far, just these first 2 months, we've seen some really crazy trading, but there's been a lot for us to talk about. Last weekend's show, I really focused kind of broadly on the major markets, also a lot on the bond market. On this weekend's show, I'm diving into the commodity sector. A couple conversations I had throughout this week was looking at the rotation that we had seen within the commodity sector in terms of investors running other commodities higher and unfortunately for precious metals investors continuing to fade, especially the gold price. I'm kicking off this weekend's show with Adrian Day, president of Adrian Day Asset Management. Adrian also manages the Euro Pacific Gold Fund. Adrian, let's start off with the precious metals. Now, we are recording this late in the day on Thursday, so we do not know where any of the closes for this week are, but as we're recording this, gold is sitting almost right at $1,770, having a rough day on Thursday. This whole month, though, it's been pretty rough for gold, and we're testing out these November lows again. It really seems like everything is going against gold for this last 7 months during this pullback. What are you focusing most on when it comes to the gold trade and potential catalysts, either to the upside or the downside?
Good afternoon, Corey, and thank you for having me. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, technically, gold is looking pretty bad right now. As you say, flirting up and down, it's actually been lower for some of today, but flirting with that November low. But really, all year, we've seen lower lows and lower highs four times. And that, you know, I think four times constitutes a trend. So that's not looking good. I tell you, one of the things that I'm remembering, you asked what I'm focusing on, and I'll get to the second part of your question about catalysts, if I may, in a second. But one of the things that I'm trying to remind myself is, if you look at gold since the end of 2015, which was really when it bottomed, and you know, it started off pretty slowly and unevenly, but end of 2015 is I think the beginning of this bull market. It was a pretty steady and slow, but steady move up, you know, slowly accelerating until we got that spike in the second half of July and beginning of August. And that spike was completely out of completely above the trend line or the channel or whatever you want to look at. And I think because gold had such an extraordinary move from the low in March to the high in the beginning of August, a very unusual move for gold, 40% in 4 months is just astonishing for gold. And then, of course, that exponential move in the second half of July. I think gold is simply consolidating. And the sharper the rally, also the longer it lasts, this wasn't a very long-lasting one, but the sharper the rally and the more above trend that a rally goes, then the longer it often takes to consolidate. So I think, frankly, that is the number one issue. The market is just consolidating those gains. And if you look back, it's very easy to get distressed today, this month, last 3 months. But if you look back, you know, over 5 years, you wouldn't be overly unhappy about the way gold has acted for the last 5 years, I don't think. So that's it. And when you're in that kind of frame, people are looking for reasons or excuses both to sell, and they're less likely to be looking for reasons or excuses to buy. And so, I mean, I remember at the beginning of January, I remember reading a lot about, oh, the reason gold's going down is because the dollar's going up, you know, the dollar's recovering, blah, blah, blah. And you look at the graph and you wonder, what are people looking at a daily graph or what? I don't see a rally in the dollar. And of course, the rally in the dollar has now pretty much completely faded. I mean, but even at the peak, it was only up 30% of the decline. I nearly said since Biden became president, since the election. Mustn't be political, right? So it only recovered 30% of that decline at its peak. Now where are we? You know, we're at 90.14, and the all-time low of the recent all-time low was 89.43. That's not exactly what I call strength. So then the narrative switched to yields, and there's no question, of course, that yields at the long end are moving up quite sharply. Although at the short end they're not, so it's a yield curve move more than a broad interest rate move. But even where we are now, you know, the 10-year at what, 1.3 or something, that's whatever inflation rate you want to look at, that's still not a very strong real rate. And of course, as we know, gold reacts to real rates, not to nominal rates. So are yields going to continue to move up significantly? I mean, that's an important question for gold. I don't really see it right now, frankly. I think there's a point when the Fed will want to push those long rates down, which they can do quite easily by just buying the bonds themselves. It's not surprising that market participants are wanting more than 0.3, 0.4, 0.5 to lend money to the U.S. government for 10 years. But that's not surprising. But at any moment, the Fed can just come in and start buying those bonds themselves, which is what they've done at the short end, and push those rates down. So I'm not overly concerned about that. I guess I'm talking a bit much. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I see this as normal market action, that just a consolidation after that strong rise, when everybody's looking for reasons. What will change? I think one of two things will change. One is you will just get to that point. You'll have the dramatic sell-off, and maybe it's coming tomorrow or next week. You'll have that dramatic capitulation when all of the weak holders are out, and then the buyers can come in and start buying. So in other words, just a simple market explanation, a market catalyst, nothing other than that sellers have sold and there's no one left at this price to sell. I mean, I'm not selling my gold. I don't know about you.
I still hold many gold stocks and continue to hold them. And I understand your comment there that this is maybe just a digestion of how strong gold did move, especially last year in 2020 and even in 2019. But Adrian, big picture here then, if you say that the bull market, or at least this uptrend, started at the tail end of 2015, that means we're over 5 years into it. Do we need to be worried about potentially this being the end of the bull market?
Good question. I was hoping you wouldn't ask. No, I don't think so, because gold cycles tend to be very long cycles. If you go back as long as we can see records, gold moves up and down tend to be long. And if you look at, say, the last 200 years, the shortest gold cycle on record was actually 2001 until 2011, a 10-year cycle. So if this is going to also be the shortest on record, we could easily have another 5 years. But historically, gold cycles have lasted almost as long as bond cycles, which of course tend to be generational things, but they've lasted 25, 35 years. So I'm not concerned about that. I'm particularly not concerned about it so long as the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world continue to create excess liquidity. Excess liquidity is the closest correlation to gold and silver that there is. And I don't see any sign that is going to stop anytime soon. In fact, the contrary, as you know.
Yeah, that's fair. And well, okay, let's then switch over to the other precious metal being silver, because silver, you look at the daily chart there and the action over the last 7 months as gold has been correcting. Silver has put in a very interesting, almost U-shaped bottom here, and the silver stocks have done better. We'll get a bit more into the gold and silver stocks here in a little bit, but in terms of silver, clearly being held up by its industrial uses. Do you still think silver has to play some catch-up to where gold is, or what's going to drive silver from here?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's got a couple of things going for it. And as you say, not only has it been stronger, but it started rallying, you know, back in the end of November when, you know, we had increased news about, you know, vaccine rollouts and reductions in, you know, COVID expectations and so on. So, certainly. I mean, I think, as we all know, but we need to go, silver has several things going for them. It is a monetary metal. And again, as I said, if you look back over 50 years, excess money creation is the closest correlation for the silver price, not the economy. But that may be changing, but that has been historically true. So it is a monetary metal, especially as, you know, gold moves up in price, so one unit becomes more expensive. You know, it's poor man's gold. Second thing, as you said, is it's an industrial metal, but I think so it benefits from the economic recovery, and we're hearing a lot about economic recovery. So people are thinking that's bad for gold. I disagree, and good for silver. I agree. But it's also a green metal, of course. Growing demand for solar panels, but more importantly, things that are not really widely known in the market. Silver is an important component of nuclear fuel rods. So if we start switching more as a world, it'll take time, of course, but if we start switching to nuclear, which I think is almost inevitable, you know, if you want A, efficient power, and B, you want green power, at the moment, nuclear is about the only thing, right? So we're going to see more of that. You also use silver in batteries. So it's not just, if it was just solar panels, I would be less enthusiastic. But it's a lot of green energy uses, and that is very, very powerful. And then, of course, the last thing is, and I'm not going to get into this Reddit short squeeze, I think they picked up a little more than they can chew with silver. But there is a genuine shortage of the metal. There are very, very low stockpiles. I mean, there's lots of differences between gold and silver, but one of the most important differences is, you know, the composition of the owners. You see so much silver was scrapped in the big run-up in the 70s. Now, there's always more that can go to scrap. But, you know, people were searching their attics back in the 70s to find, you know, grandma's old silver diningware set that nobody ever used anymore. You know, as I say, you can always find more, but an awful lot of scrap came out in those years. And there are no huge stockpiles. There's no governments with stockpiles as opposed to gold. There's no, you know, no big banks with vaults full of silver. So silver can respond very, very well to an increase in demand. So I think there's a lot more.
Okay, there's still some upside here for silver. And hey, it is encouraging to see silver holding up at closer to the top part of its range rather than seeing that downtrend in gold. Let's discuss the stocks, though. And starting with the gold stocks, the miners continue to be very weak. You look at something like GDX, and that has broken down from its November low, even after these miners have been issuing some pretty good earnings reports. Is it simply just a story for the gold stocks that investors are distracted by other sectors and even other commodities?
I think it's partly people are distracted by other sectors that do well. As we all know, you know, nothing begets buying like buying, and nothing begets selling like selling. So when the gold stocks have moved up another 20 or 30%, people will be piling in. So it's partly other things that have been doing well. People are distracted. I think it's also a you know, not untypical leverage to the price of gold. So as gold goes down, the gold stocks exaggerate that move down. I also think there's another factor at play for some of the stocks, like Barrick and Franco, which have been, you know, particularly weak. You look at who owns the stock, and the stocks that are most widely held by generalists are the ones typically that have declined the most. And when you think about it, that makes logical sense. You know, you go back 25, 30, 40, 50 years, every single mutual fund in the country had some gold or gold stock. You were a big cap fund, you had a gold stock. If you were a small growth fund, you had a gold stock. For the last 15 years, that just simply wasn't true. The generalists did not own gold at all. And there were reasons, and especially after 2011, the generalists just turned their back on gold stocks because, for all the reasons we know, they performed so badly, management's made such disastrous decisions, you know, overpaying for marginal assets at the top, writing it all off 2 years later. So the generalists just turned their back. In the last 12 months, with gold doing so well and the gold stocks doing well, you started to see generalists come back. And you'd look at some mutual funds, some still had none, but some would pick away. And the stocks that they went to most often were, you know, things like Franco-Nevada, which has proven itself in up and down markets. And also, following Warren Buffett, people jumped into Barrick. Now, of course, Mr. Buffett, in his wisdom, decided to sell. And a lot of the Buffett followers have also sold. I think that's a huge factor that's affecting some of those stocks. And as I mentioned, among you know, the leading stocks, the really leading stocks, Franco and Barrick have been underperformers in the last 6 months. But I mean, you look at, well, everybody, not everybody, no. Anyone who knows me knows I like Franco. So you look at Barrick. I mean, Barrick's earnings release last week was astonishingly good. They were firing on all cylinders. Everything was doing well. And when you look at what Mark Bristow has done in the 2 years he's been running that company, you know, net debt has gone from over $4 billion to zero. They're now net cash positive. Their mines are running well. The costs are cut. The dividend has been tripled. This year, they just announced last week a special bonus dividend they're paying, $750 million, which will be more than, for each shareholder, it'll be more than a year's worth of dividends in a special payment. I mean, everything was going well. And the things that weren't going well, like Porgera, was not news. Everybody knew it. And yet the stock and the pipeline is great. You know, there's nothing about Barrick at the moment not to like. And yet, you know, the stock just collapsed. And it was because Buffett sold. And Buffett did his filing. He obviously sold a little earlier. And, you know, you had a lot of people following. So, I mean, I think you can look at certain stocks like Barrick. And it's not the only one. I'm just picking on Barrick because, you know, it's under $20. It was over $60 in 2011. 2011, they had $12 billion worth of debt. They had hedges, right, that they had to cover at the high. They were overpaying themselves. We could go on and on and on. And then the industry was not in such good shape. Oil price was $120, $130 a barrel. And oil, of course, represents about 30% of the cost of running a normal mine. So, I mean, if you compare Barrick today with Barrick back then, yes, they were producing more ounces, but they were unprofitable ounces. And everything else, every other comparison, Barrick is an infinitely superior company today than it was back then. And yet the price is a third the price. It just doesn't make sense. Logical sense.
I think it just goes to show that a lot of investors are more or less ignoring the sector. Let's get out of here with one more comment then involving silver stocks. You and I have chatted before about silver stocks and how, quite frankly, most of the silver production comes from other types of assets, not silver-only assets. Where do you find the sweet spot in silver stocks, or are you largely looking to some of these other companies that have projects where silver is more or less a byproduct, but a large byproduct?
Yeah, a little bit of both, because you're absolutely right. Even the companies that still have silver in their name, it's not a dirty secret anymore. It's fairly widely known that the majority of their revenues come from something other than silver. And in most cases, it doesn't come from gold either. It comes from lead and zinc and tin. So a lot of these people chasing silver stocks are actually chasing lead companies. So we're doing a little bit of both. You know, companies like Pan American is an obvious beneficiary of higher silver prices, will continue to be, especially with the two huge undeveloped mines they have in Guatemala and Argentina. Who knows when they will come back on, but two huge silver mines. You know, if one of them comes back on stream in the next few years, that'll do wonders for the stock price. Wheaton, again, most of its revenue is not silver, but 30% of their revenue is silver. So 30% of their revenue being silver is one of the higher ones out there. But we're also focused, when I'm buying gold stocks, I also look at different times. And right now, I'm looking at the companies that also have copper, because I like copper, also have silver, because I like silver. And so a company like Barrick, for example, has about 6% of its revenue from copper, and that's likely to go up to maybe, not as a deliberate policy, but because of the mines, it's likely to go up to 7 or 8%. So we look, and that's not all from copper mines. A lot of that is just gold, copper porphyries. But Bristow, the CEO of Barrick, is doing the same thing I'm doing in selecting stocks. He's looking for gold mines where he has some copper. So that's one. Another one would be companies like, say, well, Osisko Gold Royalties. About 30% of their revenue is from silver. It's not well known. Royal Gold, 90% is gold, but their next major asset coming on stream, don't ask me to say the name, but the one in Botswana, the copper company in Botswana, they have the silver stream. So they have a lot of near-term leverage. When I say near-term, you know, the next year or 18 months. I'm a long-term investor, so a year is near-term for me. A lot of their near-term leverage and revenue will come from silver. I'm very, very focused or cognizant of things like that.
Okay. Hey, Adrian, it's great having you on the show. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on the precious metals. There's a lot to discuss here. And quite frankly, for gold, we really just need some sort of a bounce and some more interest coming into the sector. But this whole reopen trade seems to, well, just keep on running. So we'll see how long that lasts for. But very interesting close to the week and to this month. Let's see what March has in store for us. Adrian, great chatting with you. Thank you for taking time on this weekend show. I'll chat with you in another few weeks. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Well, thank you so much, Brian. Thank you, listeners.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.